any promise if kept that he then will fulfill, he always fulfills his side of the covenant. Or as we previously said, God always is faithful to the grace of a vocation. We can prove unfaithful to our side of the commitment, or for the present context, the covenant. Grace, therefore, is always assured because it is a covenant, and God is always faithful to his promises. What he wants from us is that we give ourselves, and not surprisingly, he will satisfy his part of the covenant, and this is a mystery, in the degree to which we satisfy our part in the commitment. Finally, and this is a long prelude before I get on to seeing the specific features of a religious vocation, but I think these are important to talk about. Every vocation is inspired by love. A good synonym for vocation is invitation. On God's part, the only purpose that he has in calling is that he might show his love and benefit both the one called and through that person those whom God has in view as being affected by the one so chosen. And what is perhaps most obvious, a vocation is responded to only by love. The more demanding the vocation, and as we shall see, a religious vocation is very demanding, the more it requires of love. And sisters, no matter how shrewdly you legislate, how carefully you plan, you cannot legislate love. The best you can do is to help evoke it. So much then for all vocations. We wish, however, to penetrate more deeply into what precisely is our religious vocation, in order that enlightened, and I'm speaking to you, you might more effectively deal with helping to plan for yourselves and your fellow religious on how more effectively to respond to the vocation. You need make no plans for God. He will take care of his side of the covenant. On reflection, we find that a religious vocation is actually three vocations wrapped in one. Or from another viewpoint, it is three-dimensional, each dimension deserving special consideration. I will be tempted and will try to resist the temptation, as I reflect theologically on each of these three levels, to not go off to make recommendations or suggestions. I hope that you will both furnish the questions and comments, that then I can somehow respond to bring the broader idea that I will share with you down to the practical, gritty issues with which you are necessarily concerned. First of all, a religious vocation is a call to follow Christ in the practice of the evangelical counsels. Before going on, I might add that what I will share with you is drawn not exclusively, but mainly from the documentation of the Second Vatican Council, not only the actual documents or decrees, but also the acta. Let me just mention one statistical detail. Do you know that for the single decree, Perfecte Caritatis, no less than 144,000 questions, comments, sidelights, issues had to be handled by the Senior Commission on the Religious Life from the beginning, when the council was first announced, until the decree was published. Indicating, I would like to impress you with the solemnity and the seriousness with which every single word of the Consiliar documentation was chiseled out. No chance phrase. No council in the history of the church, indeed, what may surprise you, there have been now 21 councils of the church. The previous 20 put together have not said as much, as profoundly, or as clearly about the religious life as the single Second Vatican Council. According to the Second Vatican Council, drawing on the wisdom of the ages, the first essential of the religious life is that it is a vocation which responds to a call to follow Christ in the practice of the counsels. The moment we say that, we touch on the heartstrings of the religious life. Because by prior definition, then, a religious vocation is a call from Christ, and therefore a call, an invitation, to go beyond what a person has to do to be saved. For which we have the convenient correlative term, evangelical precepts. Like, for example, monogamy for the married. The Sermon on the Mount for all the followers of Christ. But the counsels are something special. The best way to understand them is to see them in contradistinction to the precepts. I can't impress you with the delicacy of what I am now talking about. Because the moment we say that a religious vocation is a call to follow Christ in the practice of the counsels, and a counsel is defined as that which I need not do in order to be saved, how then, and in what intelligible sense, can we legislate for the religious life? The distinction is that it is an invitation to follow Christ in going beyond the precepts. But as we shall see, once a person commits him or herself to follow that way of life, whose essence consists in following Christ in the practice of the counsels, that way of life must have within it certain binding principles and indeed even precepts. A counsel, however, by definition, is not as such binding on all as a condition for salvation. And that, I think, is the best way of putting it. A precept, contrarily, is necessary for all as a condition for salvation. There were Mosaic precepts in the Old Law. There are evangelical precepts in the New. The best way to illustrate what this first dimension of the religious life means is to go back to Matthew's Gospel and to listen to that dialogue, which is our revealed description of what a religious vocation is. When the rich young man came to Christ and asked him in the sequence, first, Master, what must I do to be saved? The stress is on the verb must. And Christ's answer was, as we should expect, the imperative, keep the commandments. Had he stopped there, or had there been no other similar occasion, we would not have had what we do have in the Gospels, the foundations for the religious life. The young man went on and said, I have kept all of these from my youth. What more is wanting to me? Oh, Christ answers. Now that you've asked that question, now listen. If you wish, and there are many translations, the one that I prefer is, if you wish to go the whole way, what's the hypothesis in the New Testament? If anyone wishes to be a follower of mine, if you wish to go the whole way, if anyone wishes to save his life, if then a person wishes to go the whole way, then go sell what you have, give the proceeds to the poor, and come, follow me. What are the counsels? The counsels are that level of the Christian ethic, going beyond what is prescriptive in Christianity, binding on all who call themselves followers of Christ. which ethic? Only some people are given the grace to practice. Those who are called to practice it, especially put it into practice in that familiar description of the councils, in the practice of poverty, chastity, and obedience, which is more than preceptive, which is a matter of counsel, or, to coin a term, invitational. So much then for the religious life being a call to following Christ in the practice of the counsels, going beyond what is strictly necessary for salvation. Secondly, a religious vocation is a call not merely to practice the evangelical counsels, but it is a call to give oneself to the total practice of these counsels. If the foundation of the religious life, as distinct from other states of life, is to follow Christ in the practice of the counsels, the essence, and here I use the terminology of Second Vatican, the essence of the religious life consists in one's own self-commitment to the total practice of these counsels. Where two crucial words are operative, self-commitment and totality. Why is this important to emphasize? The reason is that all Christians are at times called upon to practice some of the counsels. God may bring a cross or a heavy trial into anyone's life. A young mother is suddenly widowed at the age, say, of 23. She has had the experience of marriage. She must practice chastity. But now, with greater difficulty than the average Christian, because her husband is no longer living, and she may find it hard to find an eligible marriage partner. And consequently, God may make demands of everyone at times of going beyond the universal call of duty. But a vocation to the religious life implies a call not only to practice the counsels, which every Christian is at times, sometimes, expected to practice. It is a call to give oneself so that it is a completely free decision of oneself, and to give oneself totally to living out these counsels. Let's pause for a word about the self-binding, which is part of the essence of religious life. a person binds himself where the implication is that it is not something which comes from just, say, having been born or in childhood having been baptized. Most of us had no option about becoming Christians. And when we grew up, we were no doubt happy to have been baptized and to have found ourselves Christians. But the religious life is something which a person enters into when he reaches what the church calls psychophysical maturity, where the person realizes or should realize what they are doing. They bind themselves with complete freedom. And indeed we know, and the church protects the liberty of the response of this commitment by making sure that if there is any tampering with complete liberty, the commitment is invalid. But notice, though the person is free, sovereignly free, not to make this self-commitment, not to so bind him or herself, once they have made the commitment, recognized canonically by the vows, from that moment on, the person is not free to take or leave the conditions of that commitment. Confusion here in scores of communities has been disastrous. Now, of course, even after vows are taken and the self-binding has been made, where it is assumed that there is a self-binding, that I commit myself to doing things which, if I had not taken my vows, I would not be obliged to do. Obliged, do I say? Yes. Who obliged me? I obliged myself. And as long as I make claims to living a religious life, the conditions of that binding remain. Now we add an important emphasis. While a person is no longer, as we say, morally free, having bound oneself by vow, and I would specify final vow, with proper qualifications for, say, first or earlier profession, a person is not free to say, well, religious life is a free option, so I don't have to live up to what I bound myself to. The contradiction is apparent the moment we verbalize it. Yet a person is, as we know, physically free, sadly, not to want to live up to or remain faithful to that to which a person had freely bound himself to do. In other words, we remain free agents, even though we have bound ourselves to restrict our liberty within the ambits of this way of life to which I had, with no coercion, bound myself. But the second focus of this self-commitment is the totality of its nature. In other words, there are two qualities, autonomy and totality. Autonomy in that we individually, autonomously, freely give ourselves, allow ourselves to be bound, but totality in that the object to which we bind ourselves has a fullness, a completeness about it, which for the first time in 19 centuries of the Church's history has been explained in the most lucid terms by the highest authority in Catholic Christendom. It is the totality of duration, the totality of sacrifice, and the totality of service. You can see why I began this conference by saying that I'll have to resist temptations. Each one of these totalities deserves several conferences all by itself. Just a word to be of some help to you in your deliberations on each of these totalities. It is a totality of duration. When a person binds him or herself to the religious life, the Church expects unequivocally, the Church expects that the person intends to give himself to the practice of the councils until death. In other words, there is no such thing as a temporary vocation, which therefore implies a very important consequence. There is no such thing, speaking Catholic language, as a temporary commitment. Intentionally, it must always be for life. Even though wisely, and the more unstable human society becomes, the more carefully the Church wishes to ensure both that there is a genuine vocation and that there is those qualities which the person needs to give himself to Christ for life. Hence we talk about temporary vows, which are only the Church's way of ensuring that there be a genuine vocation and a genuine commitment. Secondly, it is a totality of sacrifice. The three basic rights which we have by nature, and being rights, therefore, we have no obligation to give them up, which is precisely where the concept of counsel is so fundamental, that God gave us these rights and he respects them. Yet he invites some people to sacrifice the experience or the pleasure of the exercise of these rights. We don't lose our rights. We sacrifice the use of these rights. They are the right to the independent disposition of anything in the material order. Hence, the counsel of poverty. Each human being has a natural right to possess. We call it the right to private property, which I prefer to call the right to personal property. Each person has a right to marry and to rear a family. So sacred is this right that the Church condemns any tampering with his right. For example, by depriving even a handicapped person of his right to procreation by sterilization. It is a God-given right. Those who give themselves to Christ in the religious state sacrifice the use of this right. And thirdly, the right to the autonomous disposition of my talents, my time, my experience, and whatever technical or professional education I may have acquired. And this, of course, is what obedience should mean. The third totality is of service, where the best way to describe it is that we are to be as religious